Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Hey, it's Gemma Spegg, host of the Open Mind Original podcast, Mantra. Every Monday, I'll bring you a new mantra, a simple yet powerful phrase to help you clear your mind and stay grounded amidst the chaos. I'll also share some personal stories, journal prompts, and a weekly challenge to bring each mantra to life. Follow and listen to Mantra, an Audacy podcast in partnership with Open Mind Studios, available now on the free Audacy app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This week on the program, we take a look at the defense in what lies ahead in 2025. The landscape of college football is changing across the board. Plus, a plug in the middle, an all-timer from Eugene, goes to be immortalized in Atlanta this week. The program starts now. And welcome into the program, Dusty Hera, Cole Linehan with you. And this week we start taking a look at taking a breath and looking at things across the world of the Oregon Ducks and college football as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, there's changing every year. There's a lot of changes going on, and this is where we're going to start hearing more about it. I mean, everybody has their opinions on where college football should go, but just the landscape with NIL, with a new playoff system, is there going to be changes? And obviously there's a lot of portal talk all the time heading in.
And new players on this Oregon roster that are going to have big shoes to fill. We're going to take a look at the defense as we did with the offense just a couple of weeks ago. We'll take a look at the defense. We'll give a rundown of guys that are leaving, guys that are coming back, what to expect heading into 2025. And then we will take a look, as you said, that landscape of college football, how things are changing. But one thing that is going to be there forever in Atlanta, Georgia, at the College Football Hall of Fame, Haloti Ngata. Yes. It was voted and elected into the College Football Hall of Fame since we last talked.
Yeah, I mean, so deserving. When I think of the greatest college football player ever been around, it's Haloti every single time. You know, I was fortunate enough to play next to him. I was fortunate enough to be his teammate. And I got to see it every single day, just the dominance. And I know we've talked about a little bit with him, different stories, but it does, I mean, I can't really explain how dominant he was to the point where I've never seen him get blocked in practice. I've never seen him get beat in practice. You know, it was one of those deals where he would have, I think Schwartz actually told us about it. You know, he brought it up in our interview that they would not let Haloti practice because he would just disrupt the offense. Like, they couldn't get stuff done. And, you know, not only was he an unbelievable football player, but he was just an unbelievable person. And so deserving of this. And he's just going to, I mean, he is just, he's a freak.
What made him so much different, though? Because, like, there are guys that, you know, they're bigger, they're stronger, they're smarter, they're faster off the line. What was it about Haloti that made him so much different?
Yeah, the thing you learn in college football pretty quickly is, you know, you have people that are the most unbelievable athletes you'll ever see, right? But then there's just, like, the next level. And it's you have to, it has a lot to do with genetics.
Yeah.
Right?
Hitting that lottery, baby.
And it was the combination of size and speed. You know, when you're 330 at times, 340 at times, and run a 5 flat 40 and also bench press 505 and squat 800, you know, it's just when you can do that and you have great feet, you know, that's one thing. Like, you every now and again, you'll hear about a guy that's the strongest dude in the gym and just an absolute freak, you know, when it comes to lifting weights. But that doesn't always correlate into a great athlete. And he had it all, right? I mean, his footwork was we used to do, like, ladder drills, and he had the quickest feet, right? And
he was doing it with the receivers and the running backs.
He had good hands. He could throw the ball. And so it's just a combination, man, and to the point where we would do this drill. It was a 2-on-1 drill, right? Two offensive linemen versus one defensive lineman, and it was just an opportunity for the O-line to kick our ass, really, right? And But it was just so funny to watch Haloti do it, because it was great, because you get to read blocks. It's a really good drill to do, because you read, you know, where the offense is coming. Are you getting blocked down on? Is it a reach block? Whatever. But it was just fun to watch, because it would be two. I mean, imagine like a Unger and like a Snyder versus Haloti. And Haloti would throw one of them to the ground, knock the other one off, and then be at the quarterback. Or they would try to double team him, you know, which is 600 pounds on his 340, and he would not go anywhere. And so it was fun to watch, right? I always tell a story, and I know I've probably told on the podcast, is I can remember starting next to him in a game, and to the point where I would at times not get blocked because they were so concerned about Haloti that, you know, and I wasn't, sometimes they won't block an interior D lineman as like a read man. I was not that read man.
You were not the read man. You were just left to your own devices. Like, hey, we got bigger fish to fry. 97 can do his thing.
But you know, you talk to anybody about Haloti, no one has a bad thing to say about him. You know, just a nice guy, quiet guy. You know, and that goes from college, every college teammate, to, you know, working your way up all the way to the NFL. You know, I can only remember one story from practice that actually he reached out to the group chat about it, and it was funny. So my buddy Sean Cullen, he was an old lineman from Wisconsin, and there was a practice where he was having a, you know, he's playing scout team against Haloti, and Haloti was beating him to the point where he did that thing where you lean back and you pull him down on top of you.
But the old timber move.
Yeah, but then he put his knee up, you know, so it pissed Haloti off to the point where Haloti got up and kicked him in the head.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and it was one of those scenes where we're waiting for the coaches to just absolutely lose it, because, you know, somebody just kicked another guy in the head when he was on the ground, and Aliotti just comes over to him kind of calmly. He goes, hello. You can't kick people in the head.
Yeah.
It's almost like, hey, please don't do that. You know, and Sean's just like, wait, what? What? He just kicked me in the head. Like, are we not going to do anything about this? And then it was like, next play. And so Sean actually texted the group chat about it, and everybody instantly was like, I remember that so well. I remember it was like it was yesterday. And I think I even told him what down it was or whatever. It was just kind of, that was the only thing that only knock, I think, on Haloti was the one time he kicked him in the head and out of frustration. And
But that's a valuable learning experience for everybody, because you also learn the lesson of not everybody is treated equal.
Yes.
Even on football teams where everything is supposed to be equal, that guy has got a little bit of a sliding scale. He's earned a little bit of that. That's really funny, though, because there's just some reactions. And when a guy goes back and he lifts his knee up, you know, that could get – that's your target areas there. It's going to get you in the stomach. It's going to get you downstairs. It could get you in the right where your thigh pad isn't. That's going to hurt no matter what. He lost his cool a little bit, huh?
And Sean will say, he'll be the first to say, I don't know what I was thinking there.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it's a very low risk, you know, I mean, high risk, low reward when you do that to that size of man. But, you know, again, very deserving.
Yeah.
He's one of the greatest ever. Great people, great football player. And, I mean, he is. If you ask anybody, if you ask Bilotti, who's the best person you ever coached? I bet you without hesitation, he'd say Haloti Ngata.
Yep.
You know, and every one of his teammates would probably say that, right? And he did it, you know, he got drafted 12th overall, went on and had a great career in the NFL, you know, three-time All-Pro, two-time, I guess, first-team All-Pro, three-time second-team All-Pro, went to the Pro Bowl 5 times, won a Super Bowl, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think if you ask Ray Lewis who one of his favorite players was, he would say Haloti Ngata, because he changed his game, right? Because you have to put two people on him. He is even
can't
in the NFL, you cannot single block that man. And that just is a game changer for any linebackers.
And you wonder why, you know, as you said that, he made Ray Lewis better. He made all of Oregon's, you know, back seven a lot better. Yeah. But then also made the offensive line. You mentioned, you know, you take, for instance, Max Unger and Aaron Snyder playing alongside each other. And going up against a guy like Haloti Ngata or Igor Oshansky or Colinhan or Nick Reed, like, it was that iron sharpens iron kind of. You wonder why everybody's like, how did they find so many diamonds in the rough? well, kind of made everybody better, trying to figure those things out.
Yeah, absolutely. We had some good ones, man, up front. Off that offensive line, you think about the guys that had played up there, you know, and we talked to a great one in Devin Long.
Right? Yeah.
And we talked to him about some of the D linemen he played with Junior CVE and Haloti and just a bunch of Dorsey and just a bunch of guys that were just really, really good football players.
Well, and he gets into the College Football Hall of Fame in Atlanta. He's the seventh Duck all time to do it. He joins Norm Van Brocklin, John Kitzmiller, John Beckett, Mel Renfro, Ahmad Rashad, and LaMichael James. So two of the seven have played from 2000 to now with LaMichael James and obviously Haloti Ngata. There are going to be other guys that are going to be getting in because you think of what has been the most dominant era of Oregon football's history.
Yeah,
it's really been since 2000 and moving forward. It'll be interesting to see what other guys get their name called to Atlanta. Obviously, Marcus Mariota is going to be one guy that we all assume as a Heisman Trophy winner will be in Atlanta, enshrined in the College Football Hall of Fame. Guys are going to have to wait their turns, though. There's going to be a lot of players that are deserving of that tag and that title to head to the College Football Hall of Fame. The most recent, though, former teammate of yours, Haloti Ngata.
Yeah, so good.
Pretty good. And he made everybody on the defense around him a lot better. And today we take a look at the Oregon defense moving forward. And boy, there are some big shoes to fill on that side of the football. We'll get to that as the program rolls on. Right after we talk about an all-time Oregon Duck and Haloti Ngata going to the College Football Hall of Fame and being enshrined forever down in Atlanta, Georgia, let's talk about this defense that is going to be returning for the Oregon Ducks in 2025. Man,
there's going to be some new faces.
Oh, there's going to be a lot of new faces, especially when you think of how good Oregon's defense was for long stretches of the year and really all season long to where you're going to have some new names, new players in some of the biggest marquee roles. Jordan Burch is gone. Derek Harmon is gone. Jamari Caldwell is no longer with the program. Jeffrey Bassa, Jabbar Muhammad, Nico Reed, Brandon Johnson, Tysheem Johnson, and then Amarion Winston, who is a player who played a lot of snaps for Oregon. He entered the transfer portal before the Rose Bowl even happened. That's a lot of key contributors from this defense that at times carried the team and was a backbone. And we talked about this throughout the course of the season. The defense was the backbone at the beginning of the season and pulling games out for them.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was it. It shifted after about game three once we figured it out up front. But we always relied on our defense.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where a couple things come into play going forward, right? It's on paper, it's concerning. Just all those good people leaving, right? But you have to put faith in. You talk about those recruiting classes that we've been stacking on, right? We're bringing those five stars. Well, those five stars were backups to these guys, right? These four stars were backups to these guys. And so there are some people that are going to step up and fill roles, maybe in a bigger way than the people that they're replacing. This is a place where we now know, hey, portal time. You can go out there and not only can you go out to the portal and say, hey, this is what we have for you. We have an opening all over the defense, right, of where you could insert yourself and play early. That's pretty appealing to an NIL guy and to a portal guy coming into the Oregon.
And I think one thing you mentioned there is all those guys that we had heard before as big names in recruiting classes and stacking recruiting classes one on top of another. This is where that starts paying off for you as a team and as a program. And a lot of the names are names that you may have heard on signing day, and then you don't hear from for a while because you're growing talent, you're developing talent. Some of them we've seen in stretches and in big spots. It's not like everybody is gone. You know, Mateo Uyunglele, who was one of the best edge rushers in the entire Big Ten last year. He returns. Tatum Tuioti, who we saw massive growth from his freshman to his sophomore campaign, he is back. And then obviously he's going to be like, you know, reliable, and he may go down as an all-time fan favorite in Oregon football history. Bryce Betcher says, Major League Baseball, I'll hang on for one more year. I want to run it back one more time to see if I can improve my draft stock for the NFL, see how much further we can carry it and live out the dream one more year as a football player at the University of Oregon.
And this is also a point, too, where why NIL is it helps college football because you have some of those kids that might leave early, might go chase some money or try to get drafted in the second, third round. Well, they're making more money now at Oregon than they would. It's not a first. They're not making first round money, but anything on the top of that, you know, it's like when Bo Nix stuck around. Yeah. You know, Bo Nix stuck around because it was uncertainty about leaving, and he was guaranteed a couple million dollars to stay, right? And so that helps your roster. But it's, you know, it this will be interesting because, you know, in years past, you'd say, hey, their recruiting class from 2 years ago was unbelievable, right? And now those guys are developed, and now it's their time. You know, it's a little different with the portal and how things change, but we still do have three great recruiting classes stacked on one another. And now the payoff is time for those young pups to step up.
Yeah, and there's still that big maybe. Kobe Savage could be coming back because of the ruling in the NCAA said, all right, if you play JUCO or any non-NCAA event, a court said, yeah, NCAA can't enforce that. That's not shouldn't count as a year. So you could have potentially another season with Kobe Savage in the back end of the defense. That would be very valuable, especially with the absences of Tysheem Johnson, Brandon Johnson in the back end of the defense. But there's a lot that is coming back, and I think that one of the things that people forget because of when the injury happened and how long he was gone, at the beginning of the year it was, hey, when is the timeline for Jaleel Florence going to be? A guy who started at Oregon, he ended up hurting his knee at the end of the 2023 season, missed all of last year. He is expected to be back. That gives you a bigger body corner. You think of Sione Laulea, who came in, he's the number one junior college corner in the country. He was sitting on the bench at Oregon behind some of the big-time names that like Jabbar Muhammad and Nico Reed and Dante Manning, right? Roderick Pleasant, one of the fastest corners in all of college football. And look, I pride myself on making sure I get these names right. There's some names I just don't know. But you have Ife Obidigweyu, who is a name that we hear these names and you keep hearing them pop up time and time and time again. That is one. Aaron Flowers and Peyton Woodyard, who were in the – we're just talking secondary guys.
Yeah.
Those are guys that were the highly recruited guys who've been sitting waiting their turn. And so that's just the secondary alone. And you think of how you want to stack your secondary, right? We're talking about long guys like Laulea, who is, you know, 6'3", playing at the cornerback position. You talk about speed with Roderick Pleasant, who is one of the fastest players in all of college football, full stop. He's on the track team at Oregon, too. You think of, you know, just complete every down players. Jaleel Florence turned into that for the University of Oregon. They've kind of been building and making sure that they can build a roster in the secondary to play with different styles of offenses around all of college football, and especially in the Big Ten where you see such variation from week to week.
Yeah, and that's where, you know I've been a hater on spring ball every now and again, but that is fun to see those guys put pads on in spring ball, and you start to really get a sense of where they belong within the rotations.
Yeah.
You get a sense of how well, I mean, people stand out. Remember, we've gone down a couple of times in spring ball, and there's always a few guys that are just like, where did he come from?
Yeah.
You know, like, who is he and where did he come from?
I'll never forget the Christian Gonzalez spring ball where you came and you go, there is guy, came from Colorado. He is different.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay. He's like, Gonzalez? I was like, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're like, he just walked on the field and you were like, nope.
Yeah. And he was a secondary. Like, how, for me to recognize a secondary on being there for one practice, that just goes to show how good. And I mean, look at him now in the NFL. I mean, he was hurt his rookie year and he has had an absolute unbelievable second year.
He's one of the finalists for the NFL's comeback player of the year this year after getting injured his first year. But you're right. It is going to be one part of, like, you never know where these guys are going to come from. Because in the transfer portal, you look at the secondary, Dylan Thieneman, the safety out of Purdue, who at one time he was the number one player in the portal. Mm-hmm. He has now been bumped down to like 10 because guys like John Mateer, the quarterback of Washington State, went in. Carson Beck went in the portal. You know, all these guys go in and they bump him down. He is the number one safety to enter the portal. He ends up at Oregon, right? You Tyron Johnson, the corner out of Northwestern, he's heading this way to come for a little bit of help. And then the big boys up front, and this is going to be a big one that I have a question for you, just that development on the defensive line and on the interior. Bear Alexander is going to be on his third school in 4 years because he went to Georgia, went to USC, now he's at Oregon. But we saw growth over the course of this year from guys even like Amari Washington, right? The big boy up front played in power back and played some running back on the offensive side of the ball as a lead blocker. But guys like Tione Gray and Aiden Breland, big bodies, interior defensive linemen, what does that growth look like? Because that, to me, is where guys really come out of nowhere the developmental year.
Yeah, it just kind of depends on how they do in the offseason, too. Like, how do they change their bodies? How do they get themselves right? But the good thing about defensive line, especially interior, is you can plug in a ton of different people at that position, right? The offensive line is set. You want five guys that never come out. They work together. They work as a unit. That's not the case with D-line, right? You can develop them through getting them reps in all kinds of practices and in games. You know, there might be guys that are full split reps, you know, and you go in there and you have fresh bodies. And so if you can have, you know, four or five interior defensive linemen, you can get legitimate reps from all of them and they can develop kind of together, right, and be better players. Every D lineman wants to be a three down lineman, you know, playing first through third, but that is also a time where you can get somebody in there that could go hard for a couple reps and really see where they develop.
That's where I like kind of having the bookends. There is a known there, right, with Tatum Tuioti, with Mateo Uyunglele, and then you have Amari Washington, who's played, and we saw snaps out of him, the highly touted guys that can go up and earn those spots. And then Bear Alexander, he may be on his third college, but it is undeniable, and that guy is on the field. He can be a force to be reckoned with. And then you get guys that, you know, like guy Blake Purchase, who played as a freshman and, you know, redshirted this past year. He has an opportunity to have one of those growth years. Elijah Rushing, who was one of the top edge rushers in the recruiting class from a year ago, he gets a year of seasoning and growth under him. The defensive line, I am secondary and defensive line, I think Oregon has done a really good job recruiting forward and getting those guys in place. If there is that question, I think the Bryce Betcher return is huge
yeah,
because that losing Jeffrey Bassa and Bryce Betcher from that linebacking core would have been a really tough blow for Oregon. With Devin Jackson returning, Betcher returning, and then a guy like Jerry Mixon, the future is bright, but there's still a lot of those question marks, right? Because I think Jeff Bassa may have been the guy that now he's a Fiesta Bowl MVP. He played solid through every single game this past season. I think people kind of forget what a calming force it is to have a guy that just gets everybody in the right spot and coordinated before the play even starts.
Yeah, and Betcher's going to be that guy going forward, yep, too, coming back and with his pure leadership as well. People are going to look to him, and not only is he established, you know, on two different sports, but he's just going to have a certain amount of respect from everybody coming in, from whether it be a portal kid, whether it be just guys underneath, that he will help develop. Like, that's what people maybe don't understand is if you have good leaders, like guys that have been in the program for a long time, do things the right way, that sets your program up in just, you know, it's in untold ways. Because not only are you learning about the defense from a guy that understands it, but you're learning how to conduct your business and be a good football player and a good teammate. And that goes a long ways in development.
Do you ever have a year when you were at Oregon where you guys had to have a big turnover, replace a bunch of guys and kind of bounce back?
Yeah, I mean, just we had an interesting, you know, that first year we were there, right? Like we'd underachieved, I would say, as a team. We didn't make a bowl game, but we had a lot of good players, right? But there was that kind of that transition. Is our class was known as the top recruiting class that we have had at that time. Now it would be, you know, that doesn't compare to what they have. But I do remember just that kind of transition from that 2004-2005, all those older guys were gone, and it was our time now. And it was not only our time, but it was our time to take ownership. It was our time to go about. There were some players on the team that we didn't necessarily agree with the way they conducted themselves. We didn't agree with the way things were, and we made it, you know, everybody
you made
here.
It known, huh?
Made it known. Like,
yeah,
this is
young
not,
guys kind of turn that corner.
This is not how we do things, you know, and if you're either with us or you're not, and we're not going to deal with all the BS and we're not going to deal with anything else. All we want to do is win. And luckily we had a good core of leaders within that group that were, you know, the right, same-minded, you know, same type of thinking. And we did. There were some guys that did not make it through the next year because, you know, we told the coaches, like, these guys are problems.
Yeah.
There's an issues here.
And that's one of the things that goes untold and is unsung about an offseason. We talked a lot last week about the offseason, and this is where workouts and guys start to separate themselves, and you see groups kind of come together and guys elevate each other. But leadership roles are carved out in a weight room in January, in February, yeah. And that is where kind of when they take the field back again in March and it is time to have spring ball start up again, 100%, the pecking order has been kind of figured out of who are the leadership roles and where you turn to in times of crisis.
Yeah, I think it's been well documented, well talked about. Just the turning point too with our group was when we went off and had that team intervention almost, right? Where we came up with the saying that Chip Kelly came up with the saying of win the day and all those things. Well, we went into a room and we got into tables and each table was assigned a leader and we just started putting all of our grievances on paper. Right? This is the issue with this team. This is the issue with this program. This is the issue with all these things that are going on that we need to fix. And then we ran around the room and we had one spokesman from each group saying, this is what our group thinks. And there were some hard truths that were talked about. And there was some finger pointing and maybe there was not many names thrown out, but everybody knew a group of people that we were talking about and how we needed to change things. And it got uncomfortable in there.
Yeah, it can.
And it was, but afterwards we walked out of there with, you know, that mantra of win the day and with this idea that things need to change if we want to get any better. And that was a big turning point. It's just, I think, in the program doing that. And, you know, kudos to Bilotti for putting that together. And he even had us write on our sheets, like saying, and to him, like notes to him of things that we thought we wanted to change after that, or our feelings on, you know, on how this went. And so, and he's like, I'm going to read all of these. And there's a couple guys, you know, a buddy of mine is like, dude, he's not reading this. And so he actually wrote there and said, hey, if you actually read this, go come over and say hi to me afterwards. And the next day, Bilotti came up to him and said, hey, I've got your letter. But he, you know, but you could tell he's pissed. Right, because he was thinking that it was, he was kind of calling him out, saying, "Hey, is this just a hoop we're jumping through, or are you actually going to read all these things?" And so he wrote a little note, and Bilotti called him on it, and so
and he said, "Hey, yeah, I read your note.
I read your note," and you could tell he walked away, kind of, you know, pissed. Not my buddy, but just Bilotti was pissed that he was being questioned that way.
Well, yeah.
But hey, it was just, that was part of the healing
but
process.
I also think that that's exactly why you have meetings like that.
Yeah.
And you have accountability on both sides of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what they were looking for too, is accountability from the coaches as well. Are we just getting this room and we're going to come up with all these ideas and nothing's going to change? Or are we actually going to use the information that and take what these guys learned or what we learned from the meeting and apply it to be better?
Well, there's a lot of things that are changing around the world of college football, not just on the Oregon Ducks defensive side of the ball. There are two pretty big rulings that since the last time we had the pod, it could shift the way that college football and college sports in general operate. We'll get to that next on the program. As the world of college football adapts to NIL and what the future may hold, which with the House settlement and the NCAA going through, one part of an agreement with former athletes is, hey, we're going to have a $20.5 million pool of money that will be paid out by the institutions for your name, image, and likeness. And it's not going to be under the guise of collectives anymore. There's going to be a little bit of governance. There's going to be a little bit of limitations on what you can put on it. And it's $20.5 million. Well, as we had a change of power with the presidency on the way out, the Biden administration and their Department of Education and Department of Justice both laid down a couple of rulings that could change things dramatically. One, and mainly, the Department of Education gave some guidance on how Title IX should be addressed with a $20.5 million cap to distribute through all sports, saying, well, they see it as athletic financial assistance, and in the way Title IX has been written and ruled, that means that every dollar that goes to a male athlete should be going to a female athlete as well.
Yeah, this is very on brand for Title IX. I mean, listen, Title IX has done unbelievable things for women's sports, and it is there for a reason because it needed to be there.
No doubt about it.
But with Title IX, there is its flaws, and this is a glaring flaw. You know, this is them coming in the last second when we kind of feel like we have some stability going on with the NIL, the thing that we need the most because it's absolutely wild, wild west. Mm-hmm. 2 days after or this is going to be instated, Title IX says, oh, actually, you have to make sure that everybody is equal share.
Yep.
Now, listen, things are not equal in sports, right? College football and men's basketball pay for everything. Like, if you want to talk about true name, image, and likeness, it is for those particular sports.
And that's it right there.
Right?
Is that if it's for name, image, and likeness, and this is not to say that, look, there are so many female student-athletes that their name, image, and likeness is worth more than any cap will allow them to. Just like on the male side. Livy Dunn at LSU being a gymnast. That is a great one. Cam Brink when she was at Stanford. Paige Beckers has an incredible following. So does Juju down at USC, who's going to have her own signature shoe once she's out of college and into the WNBA. No doubt about it. But when you talk about the way that name, image, and likeness payouts have been going through this settlement, the way that name, image, and likeness really is kind of truly by definition, it is how much the institution and how much you can make off of your name, image, and likeness. Yeah. And the reality of that is, this is the same for not just women's sports, but baseball or men's lacrosse or
wrestling.
Men's soccer and wrestling. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not going to be at the forefront of name, image, and likeness either.
Yeah. And that's a great point right there, right? Because like you said, like there's going to be plenty of male sports that don't deserve this as well.
Yes.
You know, it's like the WNBA saying, oh, there should be equal pay from NBA to WNBA. No, that's not reality. Like the NBA makes billions of dollars. The WNBA loses money.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when women's soccer wanted to get equal pay for the men. That is not, you know, does it make everybody feel better? Maybe. But it's like, is that reality? No.
Yeah.
Right?
There is something to, like, in sports and their growth, in the level at which they do grow, right? Like, I had a great-grandfather who pitched for the New York Yankees. He was a cab driver.
Yeah. Exactly. You know,
he wasn't making a lot of money because at the time, it wasn't a billion-dollar industry.
Yeah.
So the billion-dollar industry is the one that allows the money to flow more freely. Now, this isn't to say that what the Department of Education said is going to be the law of the land, because a lot of the experts that in, you know, whether it's educational law or it is gender law and equal rights law, they're saying, well, Title IX is guidance. It is not going to be a way that you have to follow it to a T. Basically, what's happening is, and everybody is saying this, with the guidance from the Department of Education, you have two paths here. Because mainly what they were going to say is that, like, all right, $20.5 million, $16 million of that goes to football.
Yeah.
Right? Like, $16 million, that is your football, men's basketball. Like, that's 80%. And then everything else gets distributed to all the other sports. Probably makes sense because of the money that they bring and what, you know, it means to an athletic department of the revenues that are brought in. You know, I don't know how any individual, including Oregon, I don't know how they're going to go about this, but there's two schools of thought now that you're seeing from all the major reporters, whether it's CBS, Yahoo Sports, ESPN, are reporting that, all right, no matter what, they're saying there's going to be lawsuits. This is how it's going to operate. there's the one school of thought of, all right, we are going to go down and we're going to follow the Department of Education's guidance on this, and we are going to go dollar for dollar. We're going to stay in compliance there. At that point, what the experts are saying is that they will get sued from athletes going, wait a minute, I brought in more than my likeness. You know, my likeness brought in more money than I'm getting from this school. I'm going to sue you. The other way is that they're going to go, all right, we're going to go based off of what our numbers have dictated of name, image, and likeness. And whether it's, you know, 16.5 million of the 20.5 are going to football and basketball, men's basketball, you know, and they split that up. But guess what they're doing? They're expecting lawyers to get involved in a lawsuit to come and say, hey, you weren't following Title IX guidance. If that is the way that this is being framed by experts in the field, I think that there's something inherently wrong with the way that this has been approached, not just from the House settlement, not just from the Department of Education, but by the NCAA for years, ignoring what name, image, and likeness is and has always been. Because this started in before the 90s and before Ed O'Bannon's lawsuit. This has been going on for decades now, and the NCAA has not handled it appropriately at any turn.
Yeah, and that's the thing. People got the NCAA handled it so poorly that people finally got so tired of it that they took the NCAA's power away, right? That the NCAA used to be the letter of the law. Like, we used to have compliance guys that we would talk to on a daily basis about any little thing we did, you know, whether it be if we got a free breakfast or somebody bought us a beer or whatever the case is, right? If we put together a fundraiser, we'd have to go fully through compliance and make sure that we didn't use our, you know, Oregon football titles too much to get too much money for a fundraiser, right? And so finally people said, we're enough of this, you know, and then lawyers got involved. But then it became, now, like I said, we're in the wild, wild west where anything goes. I mean, to the point where it takes one lawyer to say, oh, by the way, JUCOs don't matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, what? So you can play for 7 years now? Yeah. You know, if you go to the NCAA and you ask for another year, they just give it to you most of the time.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
even a year ago, I mean, you could just rewind 1 year and you could say it was really hard to get that extra year.
Yeah.
Now they're like, we've gotten kicked in the teeth in the courts so many times. Yeah. We're not even going to try anymore.
Yeah. They've been the biggest losers in every court case in the last 5 years. Right. And so it's just another thing that people are going to throw a little curveball in. Right when we think we have a little stability, we're going to have to circle back, and there's going to be another judge and another courts and all these other things. And it's just, I don't know. Do I think it has legs to it? No. Right. Because of what you said, it's the individual's name, image, and likeness, which they are deserving.
Well, as the Department of Education gave guidance on Title IX, the Department of Justice also looped in and said, hey, by the way, we're going to keep an eye on this because doesn't feel like you guys have the protections by the courts to go ahead and tell people how much they can make at $20.5 million. So there's a very real possibility the Department of Justice says, wait, you guys can't tell them $20.5 million. That's not how this is going to go here. That's unconstitutional to sit there and tell somebody without, you know, whether antitrust or a collectively bargained agreement with players and the universities. The Department of Justice is saying this may be a bigger issue even if you say 20.5. So buckle up.
Yeah.
This is only the beginning. This is not the end. And that's why you're going to see also why we've seen guys like Carson Beck enter the portal, Darian Mensah, who went from Tulane to Duke, guys looking for like one last payday, is because they're saying there's a school of thought by a lot of universities that, all right, because they're going to have only $20.5 million, let's spend all of our NIL collective money now and get it all out there because we're not going to be able to use it in the future. I don't think that that's happening at a lot of the more established schools because the spending like that from a school like Oregon or, you know, Ohio State, Texas, they're not operating under that idea right now.
This reminds me of when we talked to Graz and we talked about how he was in the sweet spot of the arena football,
yeah,
and the European football, where it was like He went on a run of making really good money not playing the NFL, and that's all gone now.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to look back at these guys in these last 5 years, and we're going to say these guys absolutely hit it out of the park with NILs, because you'd like to think in five more years there's going to be regulations, there's going to be caps, there's going to be limits, you know, and they're going to at least have something under control, and they'll look back and say, hey, remember when, you know, a high school senior was getting $8 million to go to a school? Like, that was what a world we lived in back then.
Why were we doing that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think we're asking that in current times, though, yeah. But we're still asking the same question.
They're
it's
going to
be even more absurd later. All right, that'll do it for us this week. We're going to rejoin you guys when we get interviews and we have stuff to talk about throughout this offseason. And we got some good ones that are coming down the pipeline. So if we don't, we're just going to kind of free flow and go on the days we don't have an interview. We're going to find something Oregon-related to talk about. And talk with you about. Continue to spread the message of the program podcast and spread the love because we love putting this podcast out there for you guys. So continue to spread the word of the program. For Cole Linehan, I'm Dusty Hare. We'll see you next week.
Go Ducks.